This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, ours and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Can I answer that? Since I've been up here yapping away for the last few days, there's some interest in having a different perspective in terms of presenting the Dhamma. And I thought we have this nice bhikkhuni sitting quietly all these days. So it's time to put her to work. Yes, so now this will be good. I know Venerable Gotami, as a lay person, very devout, generous person, named Sally, who came to the monastery, you know, regularly supporting the monks for many, many years. So it's a lot of with a lot of happiness, mudita, and joy at finally seeing Venerable in the robes as a bhikkhuni. So maybe Venerable, you can give some of the lay people your history and how you came about.
Today when I went to see Ajahn for interview, he quickly asked me to say something about myself, about the life I'm having in the monastery. So I take up the challenge. Can you hear? I have been a nun for 4 years, and I have 4 sons and 2 grandchildren. When my husband died in 2005, he was having cancer, and a friend of mine called me from Malaysia. That's where I came from, and she asked me to go with her to Burma for a retreat of 5 months, but she only wants to go there for 1 month. She asked me to accompany her. So I spoke with my son. Many of the monks know my son, Moon. I think he's the one that is more spiritual than the others. And so I said, this friend of mine asked me to go with her to Burma for a retreat for 1 month. It's a 5 month retreat. Then my son said, if it's a 5 month retreat, why would you want to go for 1 month? Go for 5 months. And then I said, well, what about the household things? They have to be attended to. He said, don't worry, you go. And I take care of it. So I was very excited because actually I liked it very much. So I went, and in the end, my friend who asked me to go with her never went. So it was conducted by CIA Dipankara. Maybe some of you might know her. So after that retreat, when I came back to Perth, I wasn't satisfied with going for short retreats. I was longing to have a place to stay for a long retreat. So I was asking about Jana Guru, Bodhinyana, but they can't have me for long. Maybe about 2 weeks. So then I started thinking, maybe Dhammasara Monastery. So I spoke with the abbot at that time, Ajahn Bayama, and she was actually quite happy to have me, because at that time when I asked to go and stay there, there was no lay person there. So I went, I was the only one, offer them breakfast, drive them around if they need to, and of course help with whatever work is around there. And I've always been used to household life, cooking, taking care of the family. So going there is quite a challenge because it's you are doing things that are entirely different, and also some of the work is quite tiring. So I was thinking to myself, I never worked so hard in my life. So, I stayed there for 4 months, and I was quite happy. After 4 months, I went home and I went to see my mom, who is She's in Malaysia, and she is bedridden. So every year I go back and visit her. And then after that, after 2 months being away, I came back. And I went to stay in the monastery again for another 2 months. And I thought to myself, I'm actually quite happy staying in the monastery. It's a very peaceful life. I find that it's okay with me to stay and work, do all those work. It's okay with me. So I started to ask Adan Bayama again whether I can stay there for indefinitely and maybe even become a nun. And she consulted with the other nuns and also with Adan Brahm and came back and said, yes, yes, I can. So after that, I was there, and during that time, the period for training is much longer than now. Now it's very short. After requesting to become a nun, to become ordained as Anagarika, I had to wait 6 months. So do the usual thing there for 6 months, and after that, I request to become a nun, and I had to wait another, after 6 months, I shaved my head and was wearing white. So, I was taking 8 precepts at that time. That means I can still handle money. And after another 15 months, and I can request to become a nun. So, in the meantime, I wasn't quite knowledgeable about the surroundings. So I was raking around in the kuti. Raking around, then I used my bare hands to collect the leaves. And then at night when I went to sleep, why is this thing all crawling all over me? And after that I realized that it was what they call pepper ticks. They are very fine. I cannot see them with my naked eye. I have to wear spectacles to see them. And there was, I think, more than 200 of them on my body. And every day I was picking them out, and sometimes I get 50 out, sometimes I get 30, sometimes I get 60, you know, like that for many days until I got 200 over out. So I was thinking to myself, I don't know whether I can stay here. How to stand it, I was thinking. So and a lot of suffering. You think they are so tiny, but when they bite you, it's painful and itchy. And it lasts for a long time. So after that, I talked to my children, and when I wanted to become a nun, so they said, Mom, go ahead and do what you like to do. So, but only one son told me, Mom, Dad just died. If you go, you don't have anybody. I can empathize with him. I feel for him. But there come a time when the time is right, you can't give up your aspiration. So I just keep quiet. I
yes, because that was what it is. So I just keep quiet. So after a day or two, he understand. Then he said, okay, mom, you go and do whatever you feel happy to do. So, okay, all of them are happy for me to go ahead. So in the year 2009, we were ordained. So happened another two girls came in. Venerable Rebecca, if some of you know her, and another girl by the name of Claire from New South Wales. And we shake our heads together and wear white. We got ordained in Dhammaloka on the 2011, 6th of March 2011, as seminaries. But in the meantime, before the ordination, Claire left. So only leaving Venerable Rebecca and myself to ordain. And when we become seminaries, that is novice nuns, we take another precept of not handling money. So no control of money. No money, nowhere to go. Nothing to do. Bye. So then we also cannot drive. At least cannot drive out of the monastery. Because if you get involved with an accident, it's not very good, especially if it involves death. So we were there for another 2 years. 2 years to train as novice nuns. And after the 2 years, we could request again and request again to become bhikkhunis. So, and in the meantime, more ladies are coming in to become nuns already. So some nuns from elsewhere, they come and join us. So there were four of us who became bhikkhunis together in the year 2011. 27th of April. So with this ordination, we have to keep 311 precepts. A big jump. and we were ordained, there has to be about 8 bhikkhunis to conduct the ceremony, and the preceptor has to have at least 12 brains before she can be qualified to ordain us. So on that particular day, as I said in April, we were ordained as bhikkhunis. I do not find the precepts to be difficult or challenging, because I feel that it is not there to make you suffer, but it is there to protect you. Because if you take the step to become a bhikkhuni, then these precepts are there to protect you actually. So as bhikkhunis, every 2 weeks we have to request from Ajahn Brahm. I think I have to mention about how we were ordained. We were ordained in Dhammasara, and later the same day we had to go over to Bodhinyana Monastery to be confirmed in the ordination. Then we are fully ordained. So with that, with as I said, those precepts, I feel very happy to keep them and to do it. Every Uposatha day, the leader of our group, who is the abbot of the monastery, Venerable Haspalanya, she will chant the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha are the 311 rules which we are keeping. So, and all the bhikkhunis have to sit there and listen to the chanting. So, it's usually chant in Pali. So in Pali, I mean, you know what are the rules, but if you want to follow them in Pali, it's very hard to remember which is which. So it's good to hold the book, the Patimokkha book, and follow it in English. Then you know, and it's just a reminder for yourself, the precepts that you have to keep.
How long is the chant? Because the monk's only 227, that lasts about 45 minutes. So yeah. With 311, how long does that last?
311. Actually, the number has final chant very fast. Okay. it's 1 hour, 15 minutes. Okay. To have a thing. Non-self very clearly, because my body is changing, lots of aches and pains. So, but then the fact that I can continue to stay in the monastery and practice, I'm very happy and content. So that's all.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yes, questions? Yes. Polian?
Is there an age limit that a person can become a bhikkhuni? Well, there is now, because now there are quite a number of nuns there already. And also, if you have too many old nuns, then they become a liability. In fact, at that time, when I went in, I was thinking to myself, the window of opportunity is slightly open. And because of my age, and if I don't take that opportunity, I know that window will close. And I won't be able to become a nun. So I just took the opportunity when it's there. But now, usually it's around 50, the cutoff age. Yeah. But also it depends on individual case.
And so would that be the same age limit amongst as well, Ajahn?
Pardon? She asked whether it's the same age limit for the monks as well.
For the monks?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
I think it varies from monastery to monastery, but it's also a rough guideline. I know that some monastery in England, very firm, 50 years old, with Bodhinyana, I think generally that's the case, but there have been a few exceptions. Like they've been involved with the BSWA for many years, been very helpful. Then it's up to the Sangha to make the exceptions from time to time. Yeah, and I think it bears, it's just through experience that they have many older candidates. And it hasn't worked out. It's just sometimes very retrain the mind after, a long time doing their own thing. And find the older candidates harder to change, hard to kind of adapt to the life in the monastery, life with the community, life with other people, because they've been doing their thing, you know, their own thing for many, many years. And yeah, so some of the older candidates find it difficult to live in community life, and they do eventually leave. So that's why over time, the age limit came up. Yes?
Venerable Sally very nicely overlooked, she was the secretary of Buddhist Society, and for very nice service, very quiet, very good service she gave.
Many years. Every week comes to the monastery to offer food to the monks, yes, on Monday was Sally Day, we all know.
As the secretary, she was very effective.
That's right. Additional comment?
I guess that's one of the things that I was accepted because Ajahn Brahm said I've been helping a lot in the Buddhist society.
Questions and comments? Very good. Thank you for that, for your sharing us your spiritual journey. Yeah, I hope that it will inspire other ladies to take up the path. Okay, great. Thanks.
What are the
311? It's a thick book. I think generally they take where the, because the male monastic sangha was established first. They took those and then they add additional, like I said, to a lot of it's was protection of the traveling together, living close by. I think the kutis have to be built where they would within eye and hearing of the other bhikkhunis. In those days, obviously, you know, it's much more dangerous for ladies who live in the forest by themselves. Yeah. Okay, moving on. I think some of these questions might have to be saved for tomorrow, I think. But we'll see. Dear Ajahn, if we consider the characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and non-self, how do we integrate that with detaching or participating in world events or their effects which affect us, i.e. terrorism, homelessness, refugees? Thank you for your teachings. Well, that is for you know each and every one of us to make the decision when the situation arises, you know, and hopefully using wisdom, using stillness, to see how you can obviously help with social events according to your capacity, according to your situation, you know, also you know using the Buddhist teaching of compassion and kindness. Yeah, so it's not always kind of, yeah, okay, it's all suffering in every way. I'm just going to ignore this homeless person that I walk by every day. No, there's also a response to alleviate the suffering. And also, you know, empathy. You know how it is, you know, if you ever, you know, go without food, you know, what hunger feels like. If you ever, you know, sleep outside or be homeless, you know how that feels like. So then knowing that, yeah, we try to help where we can. And there's always this balancing between compassion and equanimity. Where you know you don't get overwhelmed by the suffering, the difficulties that you do see in the world, because knowing you know, when you get too involved with the suffering of the world, then that tends to drag the mind down to more confusion, more distractions, more negativity. So you want to keep the mind in a balanced, kind of bright state, and that allows you to do more good, to change the world for you know to a better place. But do it from you know each circumstance is not you know, kind of a take an idealistic position of trying to end world hunger or, you know, work for world peace. Because, you know, when you get too kind of idealistic, then it's hard to make those changes on a global scale, but we can make a difference in each of the people's lives that we come into contact with. You know, one situation at a time, one person at a time. So we can do that. Questions or comments? Is this a question or an essay? Okay. Okay, I will read. 이래요. 디라나잔 from Sutta study with Mahathera Dhammawuddo from Penang, Malaysia. Sammasambuddha, the Buddha, a Sammasambuddha appears every 9 world cycles. One world cycle is obviously many, many, many million years. A world cycle, as I was saying yesterday, I don't know what this is relevant, is one expansion and one contraction. So that's like billions and billions of years. So Sammasambuddha is called a Buddha when he teaches. The present Gotama is the Buddha because he teaches. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay, there's no questions here, so I will have to read this in my privacy, okay? Wait, aren't there other questions? Dear Ajahn, when you will be back to Jhana Grove, please do not wait for another 3 years. This is depends on the Jhana Grove manager, which is Burr. So it depends on Burr. Yes. And also Bianca, I think depends on space availability, who's around to help to organize the retreats as well, I think. Okay. So, yeah, and generally, I did extend the offer to Ajahn Brahm when I met him. Yeah, no, it's wonderful to be back, to connect with old friends. And I did say that, yeah, whenever Ajahn needed me to be here, yeah, I would try to make the time to be back, actually. So it's very pleasant, beautiful center with the plant and everything. Yeah, doing really, really well. So, yeah, happy to be back and to be of service. Like I said, we
thank
did.
You very much for this
impromptu. That's right. Originally, it was in June, but Ajahn couldn't make it to this one, so they shifted me here. And yeah, it was nice to be back in this time. Dear Ajahn, does someone who has developed the jhana or has strong samadhi automatically means has some sort of psychic powers? Do all enlightened beings have psychic powers? Are there any enlightened beings who don't have any psychic powers? Yes, there are many enlightened beings who don't have psychic powers, and the opposite is also true. There are many unenlightened beings with some psychic powers. The psychic powers is derived through deep meditation, usually through the jhanas. And a famous example, as traditional Buddhists would know, is Venerable Sariputta, which is the Buddha's right-hand man. He was quoted by the Buddha saying he has the very deep knowledge, deep wisdom, only second to the Buddha in terms of the ability to teach and to see deeply into reality. But he did not have any psychic power whatsoever. Yeah, and his other left-handed disciple, well-known, Mahamoggallana, is known for actually very his many, many psychic powers that he could do. And his wisdom is not as deep as Sariputta, but he had very deep samadhi, very deep absorption states, and so had many psychic powers. And so those are the Buddha's two chief disciples. As you can see, the contrasting ability. And like we were saying yesterday, Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, who was enlightened and had lots of defilements, lots of greed and anger and pride, and had many psychic powers that he displayed for his own purpose. Yeah. But interesting, you might know, one of our 227 rules, one of those is not to talk about psychic powers with lay people, really. Because that brings up, kind of favoritism, oh, this monk has this, and what can you do to show us? We're feeding you for so long, why don't you show us something? Numbers, lottery numbers, they're always asking in Thailand. Come on, Ajahn, just one number. Yeah, so that's one of the rules. And as you meditate, you'll see, and the advice for the Buddha as well as many meditation masters is that, don't really play with it. When you meditate, you see visions, you see things, and you have to develop them. So, you have to get involved. So that may take longer. So mostly, with meditation, the encouragement is, go for peace, go for stillness. And don't waste your time on this vision, trying to interpret it, trying to work with it, trying to, kind of see Sometimes people hear voices talking to them, sometimes they don't, and you don't need to kind of get involved in that because it's very distracting and can be very deluding. Some people, go funny based on believing all these voices that come to them. Some of it is, other dimension, other is just your head going funny. And you have to have very strong samadhi to understand the difference. Yeah. And strong wisdom to not get caught up in all that. Yeah. And some visions are true, some aren't. And so you take them too seriously, then it's also very distracting and leads you to the wrong path. But certainly some enlightened masters do use their psychic ability mostly to train their students to help them where they could. Like I said, yes, and that's the reason. But then it makes for an uncomfortable situation because a lot of people feel very nervous. They're going to a monk or a nun's presence. They know that these monk or nuns can read their mind, so it makes them not so peaceful. But like I said, a very famous teacher who had this ability, and we asked him, is that true? What do you do? Do you always scan everybody's mind when they come and talk to you? And he said, no. Why would I do that? You're going through people's minds like going through their trash. Because people's minds usually full of anxieties and worries and, things. And they say no. And unless it's also like going through people's mail as well, he said. Unless I have a permission, like if they're a disciple and they want to help out and they say, Ajahn, I'm kind of stuck in my meditation. What should I do? Then he would have a look and to see where the obstacle was. And he would try to help where he could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Questions or comments? Yes, Simon?
So I suppose that leads to a logical question. You wouldn't be able to use those powers in a normal worldly way to produce wealth for yourself or some other event like that in a typical situation. I guess there's some extremely enlightened individuals or capable individuals in that realm, but typically you wouldn't have that sort of stuff.
And that's a good thing, that's true. It's in order for your mind to develop those powers, it has to be very, very still. And you have any craving, that will disturb it. So generally people who are, like that far advanced in the practice, they don't have the usual craving of wanting more money or, wanting more power or anything like that. Because those craving in the mind disturb it, so you can never get too peaceful. No peace, no visions, no knowledge, nothing. Yeah, so generally it's true. But not always. With Devadatta, some people still have a bit of craving that arises. And that's kind of the tricky thing with these powers. If you don't use the stillness to investigate, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, suffering, and not self, then your sense of ego will start to be inflated because these are special powers and so that makes the person who has the power special. I must be special because I have these powers, but obviously that's very deluding and it's not true. Yeah, so it does kind of something that most teachers do steer away people away from playing around with too much. Yes?
I would imagine it'd be a distraction to the goal as well.
That's right, because you're not looking for peace, you're looking for things. And then you have to interpret these signs, this vision that you see. So that certainly would add at least a few more years, a few more decades to your kind of breakthrough as well. Yeah, it does add to the work as well. Yeah, because they don't, generally, they don't come by themselves. You have to, like skill and muscles, you have to develop it. So you have to play around with different things. Yeah, and it's getting a bit tricky. And that's why I think in the story, the legend has it that Sariputta, who didn't have any psychic powers, very deep knowledge and wisdom, became enlightened in 1 week. And Moggallana took, 3 weeks or something because he was playing with all these different psychic powers to get it done. But it depends on your karmic inclination and what you've done in your past life. And if you had these things, then you generally would pick them up again and work with them. Yeah, so that has there's that aspect to that as well. Some people just have an inclination, so no matter what you tell them, they're still going to play with it. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the retreat. Please describe the daily schedule for an anigarika or a trainee monk. At the monastery, pretty similar to Bodhinyana and Dhammasara, except in Wat Buddhadhamma, there's more of an emphasis on group communal practice. So generally, you would be in the hall by 5 o'clock in the morning and meditate to 7, and then there is a bit of chanting, and there's a morning reading, a passage of different teachings from the different teachers. You, as an anagarika, you will have a breakfast, and then after that, it's free time to the meal is 10 o'clock. Then after the meal, clean up, we do work from 12 to 3, different chores, wood chopping, driving around, cleaning. And then from 3 to 7 is free time on your own to take walks, do your yoga, do a bit of reading. And then 7 to 9, more group meditation and chanting. And that's generally the routine. During the rains retreat, because it's more focused on formal meditation, we do about 8 to 10 hours of group meditation together. You know, 5 to 7, 8 to 9:30, 7:30 to 9:30 in the morning, no work. So after the meal, 2 to 4, 6 to 9. Yeah, so it varies, but it's more and more intensive because there is no work. And traditionally, that's the period when you put more effort into the meditation. And you've been anagarika for a year first. And after that, you ask for the going forth again and be a novice for another year. That way, you can go forward. How has becoming a monk changed your relationship with your family? If you visit home or are invited to a pub, a restaurant, do you go? Thanks. No, remember, our meal is in the morning usually. So, generally, we stay home. Occasionally, we go to a restaurant if you know someone's birthday and they want to celebrate. But if they go to a dinner, I do the polite thing of sitting there and drinking tea or soft drink. Yeah, and I get used to it. But generally, it's kind of not comfortable. They feel bad, they're eating, I'm just sitting there. So generally, they try to avoid that. And maybe it's a celebration, they go for brunch or something. That way, you know, I can join in as well. Yeah. So with the family, some of the rules you kind of have to, be more flexible in your interpretation of the rules. One of the rules is very strict that the rules are made by the Buddha to increase the faith of the lay people, for the harmony of the Sangha, and perception is a large part of it. So monks, cannot be alone with a woman. There's always have to be another man in the room, or a monk, and with interviews. And unless it's considered a public place, generally, there's not a one-to-one meeting. And it counts even if it's a mother, because the rule, the general perception is that some monks have a very young mother. So they're sitting, talking, sitting very close, looking very intimate. People walking by don't know that it's his mother that he's having a chat with. It could be anything. So it could give rise to rumors and stuff like that. That would be not so good for the monastic sangha. So yeah, general rule is, yeah. And of course, with your home, with your mom, sometimes dad runs out and buys something. So yeah, you have to be more kind of flexible. And also general sleeping as well. You're not just supposed to sleep in accommodation where there's another lady who next in the next room or something. So that gets tricky as well. Yeah. So now sometimes you sleep, but you have a door that you can lock, then that can be interpreted as, okay, that's kind of enough for rumors not to arise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's that aspect of it as well. Yeah. But it's true, when I go home, I was telling somebody, I'm not a monk. I am just a son. So my conditioning is we sit around watching lots of TV. So that's what I do when I go home. Sit on the couch and watch TV with mom and dad. Because they're not Buddhist. They're not interested in Buddhism. I just want their son to be with them. So that's part of my thing. I go have lunch with the church ladies. Go to church with mom once. Just once. One time, mom. I don't go all the time. Mom goes every day. So yeah. So with anything, you try to, balance the monastic life and my also duties as a son and the mother who obviously a woman who raised me and looked after me so trying to be there in a way that I can. So we do that. Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, if following code of conduct helps, gives people and assist in our meditation, do you believe that we all have life purpose to fulfill? How does this relate to karma? How can we use meditation to help discover our life purpose? Thank you. No, it's true. We do have a life purpose or life lesson. And that's, you know, that is for each and every one of us to discover that ourselves. You know, why are we here? You ask yourself that. And usually I encourage people after deep meditation, pose this question. You know, why am I here? What lessons am I here to learn? And it is. You know, we're here to learn, to grow, to develop ourselves. And but it's not for me to say what your life purpose is, obviously. It's more of an individual thing, you know, where you are in your development, where are you planning to head. And, you know, and that changes as we, you know, as we grow older, we age, as, you know, family situation, relationship situation changes. And only you can answer that. But I do encourage people to do that. Pose that question from time to time, especially after a good meditation. What is my life purpose? Why am I here this time? Why am I here? What am I supposed to know? What am I supposed to learn here? Yeah, definitely, we do. We're meant to do something here. And so, possibly. Questions or comments?
What's the relationship with karma? Because you were saying that, you know, we come back. Why do we come back?
That's right. Well, usually we come back because we want something. Usually we want to be with the family, the loved one, the husband, the wife, the kids, the house. You know, there was, going back to psychic powers, there was a time monk and he can see, you know, ghosts and different things. And he says, in the West, there's lots of ghosts just hanging around the house. Because if you grow in an environment where you don't believe in the afterlife, and then you die, and then you're still there in a kind of a conscious way, what are you attached to? My house. I've been here for all these years and just kind of hang around your house. So he said, yeah, there's a lot of people hang around their house because they can't bear to leave it. Yeah. And last thing. So, you know, in terms of karma, we come back because, you know, there's some attachment somewhere, some craving, longing to be. Yeah. And that's, you know, part of the lesson. You know, why am I here? What attachment do I have that I need to clean up? Yeah. And that's the kind of part of the self-knowledge, the quest that we continue to ask ourselves. You know, what is it I'm attaching to? And some other people, it's kind of a relationship with a certain person. You can see it's a very, very strong karma. Obviously, you know, husband and wife, that's very strong. With the kids, family, that's also very strong. So that's why we come back over and over again. Yeah. Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, while sitting on the cushion to meditate, one can watch the breath with no problems. In fact, I do get peaceful, happy easily. But once the bottom is off the cushion, and when I encounter others, one gets a quick temper and annoyed easily. What is your advice on to incorporate the continuous mindfulness from the cushion into one's daily life? Thank you for your teachings. But that's the thing as well, to do some walking meditation and also kind of body awareness. That way you can keep awareness as you move through the day. It's true, meditation, sitting meditation is really nice, very peaceful. But then some people, as soon as they open their eyes, then, you know, all the peace that they've cultivated kind of out the window because they're not paying attention to the present moment. They're, you know, shoot up doing other things. So it is one of the things to cultivate a meditation that allows you to walk around and to be. And walking meditation is great for that because you're walking, you're always walking somewhere. And you're not as peaceful when you are doing walking meditation, but what peace that you cultivate and develop, you can keep that for a long, long time throughout the day because you're aware of it, you can see, you can, you know, be with the body. And so you kind of be with the body and then can interact. Then you go back to being with the body and the interaction is over. So this kind of, you know, 50% mindfulness, kind of keeping tab on watching things, it's very helpful. And then when you find that you sit down, if you keep, you know, some type of mindfulness throughout the day when you're walking around and working, then you'll find that it's easier just sitting. You don't have to clear the chatter that's in the back of the mind. Another way is, yeah, just to be focused on one thing at a time when you're doing things in daily life. When you're on the phone, just on the phone. Just listen to this person, knowing what it feels like to hold the phone in your hands. When you're doing the computer work, just doing computer work, not kind of doing phone and computer and something else. Yeah, one thing at a time, and focus on the task at hand. So this kind of moment-to-moment, present-moment awareness that we always bang on about. That's really important to help you focus when you are sitting in meditation or outside of that. So that's the main thing. You find that meditation is it's nice when you're sitting down, but then you walk, you get up, everything's kind of becomes back to square one. Then try to extend that by just being aware of the posture you're walking. Stay in the body. How's your shoulder? How's your leg? How's your hand? Just to be in the body as you move around, and keep that inside. Keep the awareness inside the body for as long as you can, and see if that helps with your meditation as you sit or not. Okay. Dear Arjun, are we really just purely conditioned robots whose nature is thoroughly impermanent? What then are we to make of the suttas that allude to an unconditioned consciousness? Perhaps what Ajahn Chah calls the original primal heart or mind that wasn't born or won't die. Isn't this permeating the mind as an impersonal awareness or citta that can observe the condition of flux and can be a source of wisdom and compassion? Could this citta be a source of boundless freedom, far surpassing any limited free will ascribed to ourself? Maybe. That is true, and that's why it's sometimes it gets confusing, because you do get described, and there's a few places where the Buddha do mention, like, the original mind, or Ajahn Chah talks about it, but it's very unclear what he means by it, and there's this kind of eternal debate you probably hear from different sides within the forest tradition even. There are some monks who also have a reputation of being enlightened, and who clearly states that when you are enlightened and when you die, the mind is this boundless thing. It goes on. It goes to a realm that seems to stay for some dimension that stays there for a long, long time, forever. And then obviously there's teachings, and that's supported by the suttas, that there is only the five, the body and mind. And when you're enlightened, you die, that's the end. No energy, no craving, you don't come back. And it's one of those, it's just, words describing, and it's, describing nirvana. It's, something very, difficult. And it obviously something you can't think your way to. Enlightened states, what happens to enlightened mind. And, so to describe, that's very tricky. So I don't know. I say, you wait until you get there, and then you find out for yourself. There's no need to get too excited, and I realized that the debate about the primal mind, is there something as a primal mind that the unborn, unconditioned, you hear that Ajahn Mahabodh talks a lot about it, many teacher talks about it, but Ajahn Brahm is of the camp that there's no such thing. If you have a perception that something that persists, obviously not enlightened. So it gets very can be a bit very heated discussion, and from my personal experience, it doesn't go anywhere. So I try to avoid these kind of hot topics of what happens to the mind when it becomes enlightened. I will say, you wait to find out for yourself. Then you know. I'll wait until I find out for myself, and I'll see. I'll let you know. Stay tuned. But what the nice thing is that they do both camp describe the end process different. But in terms of the path leading there, very similar. It all starts with harmlessness, with sila, ethical conduct. In the middle one, you cultivate, samadhi, stillness of the mind, and you go through wisdom, panya. So, so as long as you walk in that path, you'll find it for yourself. Yeah, no need to get too excited. What do you think the end product will look like? Yeah, because it's just speculation. In Buddha, many things Buddha said, whatever you think nibbana is, it is not. Yeah. And that's And that's very clear. Yes?
Well, what about the awareness that it actually makes a difference to the way I meditate?
Uh-huh.
So if there's an unconditioned mind, yeah. Then that, it's not like it pops into existence when you become enlightened, because it's not born and it doesn't die. It's there all the time. And it comes through as awareness, which observes that which is conditioned. Yes, it could get entangled with a sense of the self, but
sure.
It's still that part of the mind which is watching. It's not a watcher, but it's watching, which doesn't come and doesn't go. And I actually find it very useful in my meditation, so it's not merely abstract.
Sure, but I think the conditioned mind that you're talking about, that normal mortals cannot access. You can only access that if you become enlightened. So, but outside of that, if you think the perception of a bright, clear, primal consciousness is helpful in kind of tuning into the spaciousness of the mind, then yeah, you can use that perception as a way to meditate. Because yeah, I think from my understanding, and this is kind of, it's kind of all guesswork, yeah, that the unconditioned eye is not something that a normal meditator can access. Okay, you can have a feeling, and also when the mind is still, you do get that impression that is, boundless, spacious, bright, and clear. But I think, as far as I know, it's still in the realm of the unenlightened mind, not the primal mind. Only, like I said, only Arahant can access this kind of primal thing. But this is all kind of speculation. Go ahead, yes. Yeah.
And then there's the fish in the ocean, and the fish can only ever taste, experience water with the salt. But nevertheless, there's still something they're familiar with the water, but just not as pure water. So couldn't the primal mind come through our ordinary awareness, and it's that which doesn't come and doesn't go, which is ever present? We can't experience it in its pure form, as an enlightened person would, but it's still nevertheless, it's that which is watching, and which doesn't come and doesn't go. It's just that it becomes mixed up like water and salt and other things.
Okay, yeah, sure. You find it helpful? Yeah. You can do that. Yeah.
I don't know how this will, but there is a stanza in the Dhammapada that Buddha was saying when a monk passed away, that the Mara was looking for his consciousness. He said he will never find the consciousness because he was an enlightened being.
That's right. You can't find anywhere. It's the ghost. Yeah. So there's many description about, the mind when it, after being enlightened. Yeah, no consciousness around, or, the Arahantu, when they go through the world, there's no trace left behind. That's behind,
and
sure.
That's what is called the pratisandhivijnana is missing.
Yeah, so there are what do you call it, supports for both camps. You find sometimes the Buddha talks about the Abhasara citta, with this, the bright, luminous citta. And some people attribute that to the original mind. So certainly, yeah, it gets very complicated and very detailed. Yeah. Any additional comments or questions? Okay. Dear Ajahn, last day of Q&A, so I'd like to take this chance of asking for forgiveness if I've done anything unskillful by body, speech, or mind, which may have caused anyone any harm in any way. My questions are related to the practice in monastic life. How does a monk or nun stay in robe for a very long time, passing the 1 to 5 years, so-called the honeymoon period, if during those times they have not reached any uttari manusa dhamma, extra-normal states like deep meditation? No, I think the honeymoon is not 1 to 5 years. The honeymoon is about 3 months, I think, for me anyway. After 3 months, I kind of had enough. So the first 5 years is kind of slogging it through. You get inspired and you ordain. Think life is wonderful. You sit down and mind will be very, very peaceful. And all the monks are really harmonious and together. But, reality is slightly different. That you have very different views and opinions, and you get into kind of hairy arguments, and you disagree, and you annoy each other, and you get bored very, very quickly, because there's no TV. But, with anything, the mind settles down, you try to focus on the meditation, and that happiness, that stillness, does help to carry you through. But it doesn't have to be the super-duper absorption states of the jhanas or anything, but just a sense of well-being coming up, sense of gratitude and contentment coming up. And that's very helpful to keeping people in the monastic life. But also, I think a lot of it is just your own karmic energy for being in the robes. Doesn't mean that people who change their mind are, you know, sometimes faulty, less, practitioner, less of a practitioner. It's just different karmic come through. Some people ordain and then, you know, one of their parents gets sick and they have to leave to look after them, or they become sick themselves and it's hard for them to practice into, you know, not eating in the afternoon and stuff. So then different karmic thing comes up sometimes to obstruct your practice and your path. And that, it's not an indictment on your quality, on your skills, but yeah, these things happen from time to time. But the main thing is, if you're lucky not to have those things come up, then generally the practice of meditation will start to come together and you feel a sense of well-being, appreciation. But also, a lot of times, faith goes a long way. You have faith in the path and you keep practicing until, you know, when the mind gets together. And sometimes, you know, some monks or nuns, it takes a long time before the mind settles down. Depends on your conditioning before you come into the monk life as well. Some people will take 10, 15 years before the mind settles down. Yeah. But if they have a lot of faith and they just persist, you know, learning about what the Buddha taught, reading the Pali text, the suttas, reading about the biography of the other monks and nuns to inspire themselves, living harmonious in the community. So creating, you know, good karma as they go and learning. And that helps as well. It just settles the mind down over time. So they don't necessarily have to reap uttari manuttara dhamma, extraordinary mental states. Just kind of the gentleness of staying in the monastery, living with a nice community. People have good intention, you know, who people you may not always agree with. People who can annoy you from time to time. But just look at their intention. And happy, so we can trust each other. We're all following the precepts. You can leave your things around, not worry people will take, you know, people will gossip behind you or anything. You can have this trust. So that also helps the mind to settle down as well. Yeah, you don't worry so much about the external stuff. Second question. If a monk or nun passed away without attaining any stages of sainthood, how can he or she sort of make sure in the next life he or she will be born in a good realm, be able to encounter the Dhamma in practice again? I think for a lot of the time, it's good to encourage when you make, you know, when you bow to the Buddha or you bow to a good monk or nun, you make this determination, you know, by the goodness of all that I've done, may this be a condition, may this be a cause for me to be born where the Dhamma is, where the true Dhamma is, may I be born where, you know, where I can practice. That way you always incline your mind towards, you know, the Dhamma, where to practice, a good place. Because sometimes you make good karma and then you can go up to a heavenly realm. But it's not the place to practice up there. So you go to a place that's too pleasant. It's like, you know, you're in a holiday home. You're in a holiday destination. You just hang out in the pool all day long, right? You have the nice meal in a nice air-conditioned restaurant. So you don't think about meditating. And you don't think about, you know, reflecting on the suffering, the impermanence of these things. And you get caught away. And then in this heavenly realm, it's just, you know, you sit around, play music all day long, eat good food. And you only know that you pass away when you start to smell funny. That's how. And then within 7 days, when you have this funny smell, you pass away and you go back to the earth realm or the animal realm. Depends on how much good karma you used up when you go up there. Yeah, so that's the traditional kind of Buddhist fables about rebirth and heavenly realm. Number three. I've heard someone said that a monk who merely eats, sleeps, and does the basic daily chores around the monastery without doing any meditation will still be born in a good realm because he's accumulated enough merits from keeping the 227 vinaya rules. Is this true? Thank you. You find that actually we all have a certain amount of attachment, greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind. And when you're in a community, like a monastery, it's like a container. Once things settle down, these forces will come out. And if you have a lot of attachment, defilements, views, and opinions, and you get irritated easily, it's sometimes it's very hard to stay in the community for very long. because that's why the training, the first 5 years as a monk or nun, anyway, you cannot go and stay by yourself and meditate 24/7. You have to stay in the community. And certainly the Ajahn Chah tradition, that is a requirement. That way you kind of rub and away each other's. You know, we all come in with spikes around us. And through just living close to each other, you rub and you grind all those things up. And then, you know, those kind of the coarse defilements rub away. Just learning to live with each other with peace and harmony. People are very different from you are, different perception, different habits, you know, different ideas of what practice is like. And in the monastic life, it's very hierarchical. Who you are dating with is who you're stuck with. And they sit to you, to your right and to your left, every single day. You kind of like, oh, I'm going to sit with my friends over here. You two sit over here. And the monks sit right, and that can be very annoying because they're very different than who you are. So we have a monk who said, you know, if the people that he has to sit by, has to deal with it when he's in the monastery, are the people, if he sees them on the street, he'll go run to the opposite side of the street to avoid them. But in the monastery, you cannot avoid. So then it does open up the opportunities to say, okay, you know, I cannot escape from these people. Then you have to use your wisdom, use your mindfulness to see, you know, to look at the positive sides of the people you live with. Even though if you don't agree and you get into a lot of arguments, you know, how can I live in a skillful way? So it does force you. Because in lay life, we only hang out with people we like. So you don't like, you don't deal with them, you avoid them. You unfriend them, unsubscribe from all their social network, whatever. But in the monk, yeah, go ahead.
You just described married life.
That's right. No, it's also a very good practice. That's right. But you can't get divorced. You have to stay for like 20 years. And as the monk, it's the same. Yeah, and that's what you're like. Yeah. But married life, at least you choose each other. We don't get to do that. Whoever anyone you're stuck with, it's like, I never want to be sitting next to you. But the good thing is, over years, you do learn to appreciate, and you watch how the mind changes. Like this person, obviously, you know, when you met, annoys you in so many different ways. All of a sudden, you're going to be good friends, that you do appreciate their intention, and that the mind changes. And that's why it shows, you know, kind of impermanence, things change, and that you can work with. And also, sometimes you can see your own mind. If the mind is peaceful, you had a good day, this person is really a nice friend to be with. And you had a bad day, he's annoying in so many ways. Well, what is the truth? Is this his person or is this just the mind? Yeah. So it allows you to work through all those issues on a communal basis as well. That really isn't the external that we like to think. It's always usually the internal bit, how we relate to it. Yeah. And so that's why monastic way is the great kind of container to, you know, for people to work with. And it's true. Family relationship, also work environment. Because that's in that place, you also cannot avoid people you don't like. If it's your boss, it's a person who's annoying you, well, yeah, you don't have much choice. So it's also a good opportunity to work through, you know, different ideas and habits. Yes?
What if somebody comes to the monastery and they've got like issues or abuse of people? For whatever reason, I mean, are you supposed to, as a monk, go, okay, it's not, you know, I mean,
yes, I do say that. I said that a lot in my junior years. No. But what you can resolve issues. So, you know, if you find this conflict happens and it escalates day in and day out, you do try to resolve it by sitting down with this person, but also following the five standards that we spoke earlier. That, you know, you establish the fact. What happened, what he said, it was really said, his intention behind it. You wait for the time and place, make sure he's in a good day. You don't make sure, you know, you don't wait until he stays up all night, practice, and then you hit him with, you know, a long list of things that he's been annoying you with. So time and place is important. This ability, you know, this metta, you know, doing it for his benefit, which, yeah, that's the trickier bit. Yeah. Are you doing it, you know, to make sure that he grows? Because he's making the same mistakes, you know, getting the same fights with you and other people. Yeah. But other times you also go to the teacher and, you know, Ajahn Brahm usually decides, okay, you know, how. Because occasionally we do get, you know, people come in and they have a lot of issues to deal with and not as stable and slightly divisive, of course. But as community, you try to give them as much space, give them the benefit of doubt. But also, you know, with Ajahn Brahm, he's getting better. Before he said, oh, out of compassion, you know, if they're this difficult in this place, it's the only place that they can stay in. Outside, they would get harassed and yet, you know, they couldn't stay in the outside community. So why don't we give them the opportunity to stay with us? But then they usually create a lot of, you know, division and disharmony. So then Ajahn Brahm is getting better. So now he says, you know, I have compassion for one person, but I also have compassion for community. So then he looks at the whole community, you know, is this person being in the community is going to be too divisive and cause too much suffering? And then he would say, well, you know, yeah, at this time, you know, we can't accept you. You know, maybe you can work with different issues, and then you can come back later when things have calmed down. Yeah, so it does work that now. And it's a Sangha decision as well. So anybody who's accepted into the Sangha as a novice or a monk, you need a unanimous vote. So that's one of the way to That's right. So there is a system to address it, obviously, and to work through. But a lot of time, in the monastic life, it takes longer. Yeah. If lots of people complain, then Ajahn would take that up in the Sangha meeting. We have the Sangha meeting every 2 weeks when we recite the rules. So that's what we bring up businesses, you know. There's any division or any disharmony in the kitchen or in the Sangha, or people misbehaving or whatever that brings up. You know, and then that gets addressed. And then we usually, if the person who is at the center of the issue gets questioned, you know, to make sure that it is the fact, obviously. So we allow people to address the issues directly. Yeah,
the
sure.
Car.
The what?
The naughty car.
Sorry. And yeah, generally it's pretty... pretty easygoing. Rarely do we get, you know, kind of too confrontational, different things and different issues. Yeah. But also, yeah, I think with Venerable Gotami as well. Yeah, the first few years, it's generally a steep learning curve. So I remember, having a fair amount of difficulty being a young monk, just going, why so many rules? They don't make sense. Why can you eat chocolate and sugar but not an apple? Doesn't make any sense. But there you go. I don't make the rules. Huh?
Why is that?
I don't make the rules. I just follow them. It's just for simplicity. And the sugar bit, it was meant to just keep your energy up. And then it's also we inherit the Indian system of classifying food. So that's where it comes from as well. That they classify certain things as food, which you only eat before 12. Other thing as tonics. That just helps the energy, but not considered food. So you get butter, which is not very good, sugar, honey, and ghee, which some places get interpreted as like cheese. But it's, yeah, so some milk product. Yeah. And then everything else is considered food, which means you have to eat before 12 o'clock. Yeah, yeah. And it's for simplicity, you know, because we live an alms mendicant. So in the early days, a monk ate 3 meals a day. Nice time. But then people start to go alms at night, and that scared people. So they didn't like that. People knock on their door at night looking for food. So then they complained to the Buddha, and that's why he made the rule. Just eat in the morning. That way you can do alms in the morning, and that's easier. People will feel more comfortable. Otherwise, you know, all these weird people are knocking on their doors at night looking for food. Yeah. So that's why there's a rule. Dear Ajahn, I find the use of mantras very helpful. Do you have any suggestions regarding mantras for restlessness, impatience, difficult to sit through during meditations, and fear? Thank you. Restlessness, like I said, you know, just right. Whatever's happening, just right, or this is good enough. Other ones I use... You can also look at any mental states that arises, not me, not mine. Yeah. So you don't have to change, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to control it. These things come, not me, not mine, not my problem. Yeah, you can say that to yourself, not me, not mine. Anything that comes up when you find it's not settling down. And what other ones that sometimes I use? Some Brahms use shut up, shut up. That works for some people. Just keep the mind long, stay long enough time, it'll shut up eventually. And you can point the mind towards like the more wholesome Dhamma. Just stillness, peace. Just say that, you know, and then see where the mind points to. Stillness, peace. See what that feels like. Yeah. Do that as well. Any other comments from other people who find anything particularly useful? The mantra? A lot of time, experiment. Just use your own different things. Yeah, then come up.
Mantras like in Pali or Hosam or things like that that actually have power in their resonance because of...
No, I think that sometimes they do the Pali chanting and as a blessing and people think there's kind of a power inherent in themselves. For myself, I think it's the focus, the power of the mind that gives it the extra oomph. Yeah. So when you know lots of monks chant and they have a very peaceful mind, they spread this energy out. That's where the blessing comes from. It's not so much from the Pali chanting, but it's the power and the purity of the mind that radiates that. And then also the purity of the receiver to receive it. So there's usually two factors. Whether you receive the blessing correctly is the purity of the sender and the purity of the receiver. Usually how pure and how close you are to that person. So like you metta meditation, you send it to your parents or your loved ones. You'll be surprised. Sometimes they receive it. Like, oh, I was thinking of you. I had a really nice thought about you. During this weekend, what have you been doing? Oh, I say, I've been sending you metta, Mom. Yeah, so you can get those things as well. Yeah. And fear, mantra for fear. I'm not a fear. Fear doesn't come up so much for myself, but any suggestion for fear? Fear is obviously a holding on to something.
Huh?
Yeah, may all beings be well, may I be well. Yeah, just wishing yourself wellness if you feel a bit, you know, kind of shaken, scared, fearful. May I be well, may I be happy. So kind of, for fear, more of a metta, a kind of, holding yourself with kindness and gentleness, more of a thing that's helpful. Not so much as a mantra, or any mantra relating to the Metta Sutta, you know, may all beings be well, may all be happy, and may I be well, may I be happy, you can say that over and over.
I quite like, if you want peace, be peaceful.
Right, make peace as well, that's fine, that's good. If you want peace, be peaceful. Okay, I think it's 9:30. Okay, just fan notes, so I have to go through there. That's right, just a comment only, and then we can end it. It has been scientifically proved, and it wasn't cited in which journal, but the most happy and calm people are the Buddhist monks. The brain chemical composition and structure can change when a person meditates to successfully for a long time. And may they have no adrenaline rush. I think it's a few years ago, I think at the research in Harvard University when they hooked up a Tibetan monk who now is dubbed as the happiest man on earth or whatever, that apparently he had very good meditation and calmed his mind down, and his chart shot up the graph in terms of a sense of well-being. When you feel peaceful and a sense of well-being, are happy, then a certain adrenaline is produced in the mind, and they can kind of monitor that. And they hooked up this Tibetan monk, and he just kind of went off the charts with the level of happiness in his mind. Yeah, so that is more and more research into the brain, and to see how meditation changes. Actually, we're much more changeable. The brain is much more changeable through the mind than we think. That it can heal itself and it can change, alter the way it works. The hard wire of the brain can also change through deep meditation. Yeah, and that is true, that you are kind of exercising certain lobes in your brain in terms of empathy when you meditate, in terms of the connectedness. And that's why the feeling when you are meditating, you open your eyes, you have all these good feelings because those centers in the brain are activated. And then so those grow over time, and the centers, the lobe where fear and anxieties generate, that shrink. It's the same thing, you know, whatever you focus on, that grows. And the stuff, the other one shrinks, you know, by itself. Yeah, so those, are, and then doing more and more research, you find out, you know, to kind of establish the link between meditation and feeling of well-being and how the brain works as well. Yeah. So on a good note, we will leave the other questions for the final session tomorrow morning, I think. There is a different schedule, so please have a look on that. And I think we will give the morning guided meditation. No, there's a morning talk at 8:15 to 9:15. So that will include the Q&A in there, and then the metta meditation from 9:15 onwards. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you for your contribution, comments, and thank you, Venerable Gotami, for your spiritual journey.